This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. It's a big Friday here in Massachusetts. Time for our weekend review on the last day before the Commonwealth takes the masks off, mostly, and fully reopens.
Today is obviously a big day in our 15-month fight against COVID-19. The people of Massachusetts have been through so much over the past year, but together they have done a spectacular job of putting COVID on the run.
Governor Baker is also extending outdoor dining options, and that's been a big hit for customers and restaurateurs. Here's Restaurant Association President and CEO Bob Luz.
It wasn't just for the fact that there was the middle of a pandemic and they didn't want to go inside. It was they enjoy eating outside. They enjoy having a meal and a glass of beer or a glass of wine or a mixed drink from their favorite bartender.
It does sound like a nice way to keep cool, but the heat is on Baker as new scathing reports chronicle mismanagement at the state-run Holyoke Soldiers Home, where dozens of veterans died of COVID-19 last year. Here's State Rep Linda Dean Campbell.
Now we need to begin to legislate to put these structures in place, because otherwise you're simply taking the chance that a muddled chain of command will just exist and no one will be accountable or responsible, and that sets up another perfect storm for another tragedy.
Also this week, more developments in the Boston Police Commissioner saga and the anniversary of the murder of George Floyd, which sparked protests and calls for change from people like Roxbury attorney Carl Williams.
The idea that we should take 10% of the Boston Police Department's annual budget and we should use that for public health and to educate children, that is completely now a rational, acceptable thing because people were in the damn street marching and chanting it.
And that's where we'll begin this week. Where are we on fixing the BPD and on reforming policing more broadly 1 year after Floyd's murder? And what's next in the Dennis White drama? Call us. Join the conversation. The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And with us this week, we've got former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift, now the president and executive director of Learn Launch. Governor Swift, welcome back.
Thank you for having me again.
Also with us is Renee Graham, a Boston Globe columnist and a WBUR contributor. Renee, great to have you back as well.
Thank you. Good to be back.
All right. So listen, it can be hard to keep track of the back and forth in this Dennis White saga, but let's run through the basics real quick. So White was promoted to police commissioner by then Mayor Marty Walsh back in January. Renee, your paper, the Boston Globe, then reported for the first time publicly that White had been accused of domestic violence in the 1990s. The city then put White on leave, and after an outside investigation, acting Mayor Kim Janey is moving to fire White. Now, he's fighting that effort in court, but appears to be losing. And here's what's next. Janey says she will, quote, immediately move forward to schedule a hearing with Dennis White. So, Jane Swift, what do you expect that hearing will look like?
Well, I think that she likely has lawyers who are telling her she has to follow a fair process in order. And frankly, it is the type of vetting and process that this gentleman, and I use that term out of respect for the office, not the person, should have been subjected to have all of these allegations and all of this heard with transparency in the first place. But it will allow her to then move forward. And if, in fact, all of the information that the Globe has brought forward proves to be true, then with due process, she will be able then to move forward to end his leadership, short as it's been, of the Boston Police and find her own person to put in place.
You know, Renee, I'm wondering what you think should happen next here, because White has asked for a trial-like hearing in which he or his attorney could cross-examine the witnesses who formed the basis of the city's decision to fire him. Now, a Superior Court judge ruled this week that the hearing doesn't have to resemble a trial. And so here's what White's attorney, Nick Carter, had to say about that.
Commissioner White respects the court's ruling. He now reaffirms his request to Acting Mayor Janey in his letter to the city. He asks for a copy of the investigator's file, including at a minimum the identity of who is making these false allegations against him and what their source of information is. And he asks for a public hearing where he can present his evidence with witnesses that prove he is innocent, he did not commit domestic violence, and there is no cause to remove him as commissioner.
So, Renee, the court ruling means the city doesn't have to grant White's request, but, I mean, should it for the sake of fairness and public confidence in the process, you think?
I don't think it would be a mistake to do so. And I think what's important here is for everyone to come clean. It's not just about Dennis White and what Dennis White did or didn't do 20 years ago. Certainly that's part of the story. But also, how did we get to this point? Who knew what when? Who's lying now about what they knew? Is that former Mayor Walsh? Is that former Commissioner Billy Evans, who both claimed that they had no idea that these allegations even existed? Meanwhile, you have former Commissioner Willie Gross saying they've known since about 2014. That's a problem. And they need to get to the bottom of this. It's not just a matter of, and maybe that's what Dennis White wants to do. Maybe he wants to pull all of that into the light, because in addition to everything else, with having Walsh and Evans say they knew nothing about it, they're calling him a liar. And they're calling Willie Gross a liar. So maybe if he has this sort of trial-like hearing, you know, we can find out what happened and he will get some sort of satisfaction. I don't know that he should be commissioner, but I think we do need to know what happened, when, and who knew what when.
Well, let's get into that question a little bit, because as you say, one of the many points of dispute here is whether former Boston Mayor Marty Walsh knew about these allegations against White when promoting White to commissioner. Walsh is now the U.S. Labor Secretary. And here's what he said on All Things Considered this week when NPR's Elsa Chang asked if he knew.
No, I didn't. And I made a statement on that last week. Those allegations were 25 years ago. And that's why when it was brought to my attention, I immediately brought in an outside investigator to look at the case. I was hoping to get this resolved before I left as mayor of the
city.
Did
you feel that you should have known about those allegations before you appointed him to be the commissioner of the police in Boston?
I probably should have brought to my attention.
Okay, but former police commissioner William Gross says it was brought to Walsh's attention. Gross says that Walsh was briefed on White's history back in 2014. So, Jane Swift, I'm wondering whether, as a former governor, you think it's possible for both claims to be true. I mean, governors and mayors have a lot of information come across their desks. Could it be that Walsh did receive a briefing packet on White 7 years ago, but didn't read everything in it?
So I think you make a good point. Or Gross could have told someone who said they told the mayor, and that person didn't tell the mayor. You know, we have these systems where sometimes the people around you believe they're protecting you by not giving you information that is potentially damaging. I think one of the most important lessons of leadership that has come out here is one of the most important things a leader can do is to surround himself or herself with people who will tell you the things that you don't want to hear, who will give you the bad news, because it always eventually comes out. And the longer that those difficult, uncomfortable things don't get to you, usually the worse it becomes.
Renee, what do you think about that? Do you buy the idea that former Mayor Walsh may not have known, or do you think that there's a clear truth and a clear fibber here?
Well, I mean, look, we can ask ourselves the question, when former Commissioner Gross rather abruptly retires, where was the vetting process for Dennis White? We shouldn't even be at this point. Dennis White was already a superintendent. Was he vetted when he got that job? This is the problem. This speaks to Walsh's leadership as mayor. These are things that he should know. But I think sitting back at this point now from his perch in the Biden cabinet and essentially saying, yeah, I didn't know anything about that, and yeah, I guess I should have, he's not going to shrug his way through this. People need to understand how this happened and what he knew. And if he didn't know, what that says about his ability to lead.
Again, listeners, if you'd like to join the conversation about the Dennis White saga or policing more broadly, you can give us a ring at 1-800-423-8255. Again, that's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can always tweet at Radio Boston. You know, it strikes me that a complicating factor in this case is that we have two ugly histories colliding. We have White's attorney arguing that White is, quote, facing an all too familiar circumstance for a black man. Any charge of violence against him is presumed to be true. Allegations are made up to control and punish him, and he's not afforded due process when accused. Now, whether or not that's what's happening to White, there is a history of what his attorney describes. And there's also a history of subjecting women who've survived domestic violence to painful trials or hearings that can re-traumatize them. So, Jane Swift, I mean, how can the city move ahead here in a way that affords a black man due process and also protects a woman alleging domestic violence?
Well, I'll tell you, there's also a third thing that's all too familiar, which is a woman rises to power and a complicated political situation is all of a sudden thrust into her lap where, frankly, there is no good solution.
You're talking about acting mayor Kim Janey here, of course.
Yeah, and all of a sudden, you know, she is getting a lot of the political heat for something not of her doing, where there really is no good solution politically. And so, you know, that's the third no-win story here. But that's the burden of leadership. And I think so far, she has shown assertive leadership, which I think is an important thing. You know, I think often about what my mother, who was raised by first generation Americans, would say to me. And it proved true in a lot of situations like this, which is life isn't fair. And so, you know, Dennis White is entitled to a fair trial if, in fact, any of these allegations were ever brought against him. But in politics, particularly in Massachusetts, things aren't always fair. And so I would say fairness in terms of leadership in the public arena just can be judged on many dimensions. And for each of us, I think we unfortunately accept sometimes, particularly when you go first, that you're going to have to deal with some of these issues and, you know, do the best that you can.
Sure. And just to clarify, when you say trial, of course, we're talking about this hearing process, this process right. that the city is going through. It's not a it's not a criminal right. trial or a civil trial. Yeah, Sarah is calling from Melrose. Go ahead, Sarah.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for having me. Very briefly, the commissioner sounds like he has a sense of entitlement to stay in the role. My biggest concern is that you address what seems to be a glaring issue, which is just that the point of trying to have his ability to call witnesses is to intimidate those witnesses. And I think it's very suspect where he and his lawyer are coming from. And it's quite obvious what the motivation is to anyone paying attention. So could you please address the motivation behind his desire for a hearing that's public, because it is meant clearly to expose and intimidate people, the people who've been reporting on his past. Thank you.
Okay, Sarah, thank you for the ring. Renee Graham, I'll toss that one to you. What do you make of Sarah's point there?
I mean, I think she does have a point. I mean, but it's, I would find it really interesting in some regards that Dennis White now wants to have this trial-like hearing, and he wants to call witnesses, and he wants all this information to go out. But we know that when an independent investigation was done into the allegations, that Boston police officers were discouraged from cooperating with that investigation. And so the idea that now it's like, no, 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 I want to tell my story now, let's get it out, seems a little disingenuous, if nothing else. I feel like he's sort of dragging this process out. He has to know he's not going to be commissioner of Boston Police. But I feel like he's dragging this out, perhaps in a way to sort of punish Walsh, you know, perhaps in a way to punish Kim Janey, who's now, as the governor mentioned, in this position where she has to clean up this mess made by all of these men. So yeah, I do think that he wants, I really just think he's sort of running out the clock for as long as he possibly can. But again, there's been an independent investigation into these allegations, which were worse than what people initially thought they would be. And I don't know. I mean, I really do think that the intention here could be to get it all out there, but also to intimidate people, but also just try to come out of this as whole as he can. If I could just quickly address one other thing. You know,
sure,
when you talk
ahead,
about when he essentially says, you know, these allegations are false, I didn't do this, what he is saying is these women are lying. And we've heard that too many times. We know how that goes. And this idea that somehow women run around making allegations against the men in their lives or just men they work with, or whatever the case is, because it doesn't make them look better. They don't get public support. So you always have to ask yourself, why would they lie?
Let's take one more call while we're on the subject. Sorry, Jane. Let me have you address what our caller is asking about. Paul is giving us a ring from Chelsea, and then Jane Swift, I'll come right back to you. Go ahead, Paul.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just want to point out that there's a very similar story with Stephanie Pollack, who is now the deputy of the Federal Highway Administration. She was in charge of the registry when 8 motorcyclists in New Hampshire died because the state hadn't been doing their job with rescinding licenses for people who shouldn't have been driving.
Thanks for the ring there, Paul. Yeah, so a state matter there as opposed to city. Jane Swift, do you see any overlap or commonality there as Paul sees it?
So I think the difference, Paul, is that that issue was thoroughly brought out before Pollack was given that appointment, and clearly the Biden administration looked into it and decided to proceed. I did want to just go back. I think Renee said this, but to Sarah, the caller earlier, clearly it should not be required to re-victimize the women who came forward and made these accusations several decades ago. And yes, there is more than a little bit of a whiff of intimidation to say that, you know, they need to come forward. There's tons of research and reasoning for victims of domestic violence to not have to be re-victimized in that way, but particularly when their accuser is a powerful police commissioner, and this is not, as you said earlier, a trial.
Sure. Renee Graham, I think we could probably spend the rest of our time together unpacking the particulars of this Dennis White story, but I do want to try to pull back and look at the bigger picture. You know, White's promotion was supposed to be a mark of progress for policing in Boston. He was the city's second Black police commissioner, the second in a row. What's your overall appraisal, if we step back, of the Boston Police Department and racial justice right now?
That's a big question. I mean, I think the Boston Police Department is a mess. I think that the decades of rot in that department are really coming to the surface now. And it's very hard to talk about police reform when you have a police department that really keeps its own counsel and feels like it can do what it wants untouched. You know, we have to have these important conversations, obviously, in the year since George Floyd's murder. But, you know, when you talk about reform, and I use that word cautiously because I don't believe the system is open to reform. But when you talk about reform, you're not just talking about how police behave in the streets. You're talking about what happens within that station, what happens within that department, because that impacts the way they behave with the general public. And I think this idea that the police are in Boston are pretty much doing what they want. They're intimidating people. They have racial issues, that all of these things are kind of boiling in the police department, have to be dealt with before you can really get to, you know, beyond that and talk about what does the Boston Police Department need to do to better its relationships with a community that increasingly doesn't trust them.
Sure. Well, and as you rightly point out, we are having this conversation as we head into the Memorial Day weekend, which marks the anniversary of George Floyd's murder by Minneapolis police. And of course, his death sparked protests all across the country and here in Massachusetts. The officer who knelt on Floyd's neck, Derek Chauvin, was convicted of second-degree murder last month. And WBUR's Adrian Ma checked in with some local activists this week and asked them this.
The kind of change you want to see that you're working for, do you think you'll get to see it?
I hope so. I'm not that old, but I mean, I'm getting there, but I'm not that old. I hope so.
It just feels like there's so much that needs to be done. And even if it were to take place, I wouldn't see it in my lifetime. My kids wouldn't see it. My grandkids wouldn't see it.
One of the things that people have said to me is like, we don't win the day that we get all the things that we're demanding. We win the day we start to fight.
That was Shanakawa Pereira, Tanoa Pierre, and Carl Williams. Renee, how are you reflecting on this past year and what's changed or hasn't in our state?
You know, a year ago when people were in the streets and they were demanding change, there was this sort of bright shining moment when you thought, okay, this is the one, this is the thing that's going to turn it around? And I don't know that I've seen that much change in the last year. I've heard a lot of talk about it. You know, I think, you know, we had these sort of optics of police kneeling with protesters and that sort of thing. But where are we? Black and brown people are still dying disproportionately in this country by police violence. There isn't this sense, you know, the whole idea of defunding the police got completely perverted by conservatives in the right wing to mean something which it did not necessarily mean, which kind of lost the thread of how you reform and change the culture of policing, because we are talking about the culture of policing. And so I don't know, you know, optimism isn't really my default setting anyway. So I don't know, I don't even feel the small optimism. I don't even see the small light that I saw last year, because I feel like things are the same. And if anything, I feel like a lot of police departments, including BPD, have really dug in their heels and made it clear that they feel no need to change.
How about you, Jane? Are you any more optimistic than Renee?
Well, so unlike Renee, I'm actually usually quite an optimist. So we've had an issue out here, much smaller scale in my local hometown, where we had some really significant racial issues. A police chief lost his job. And what I will say is, in the subsequent election, the voters voted to support the folks who supported change. And so, you know, it is not a majority Black community. We have a very small minority representation, very few people of color. So I think that's the only point of view that I can speak from. And so I would just take my observations from that perspective. And I'm not sure it's as important as Renee's perspective, but I do think at least there is increasing attention, and people of goodwill are trying, but that may not equate to things being different where it really matters.
Still with us, former Governor Jane Swift and Boston Globe columnist Renee Graham. Renee, Jane, the day we've all been waiting for is almost here. Here's Governor Baker at the State House this afternoon.
This progress has made it possible for us to lift all remaining COVID restrictions across the Commonwealth effective tomorrow. As a reminder, all industries will be permitted to open, all capacity restrictions will be lifted, and all gathering limits will be rescinded.
Hey, tomorrow is a big day, no doubt, but the on-the-ground reality looks to be a bit more complicated than the state's new guidelines suggest. So let's get into it. And listeners, we'd like to hear from you as well. Are you excited to see pandemic rules expire? And what are you looking forward to doing? Or are you a little bit worried that we could be moving too fast? Are you concerned? Are you going to have to prove that you've been vaccinated just to get back to work or go other places? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And you can tweet us at Radio Boston. Jane and Renee, I'll answer my own question first and then put it to you. I, for one, am excited to gather with an extended family this weekend and see my 95-year-old grandmother for the first time in more than a year. How about you, Renee? What are your plans? Are you excited for this full reopening?
I would not say I'm excited for the full reopening, although I am looking forward to seeing family and friends as often as I can. You know, it's funny. A reporter today asked the governor if COVID is over, and he said, unless something odd happens, he would say it's quote unquote pretty much over. And then he put an asterisk over, you know, over the word over. And my first thought was, over for who? You know, just, you know, when all these efforts and yes, people are getting vaccinated, but the same communities that were getting hit hard a year ago are now have the lowest vaccination rates. So it's not over in those communities. So I think there's some, it's not just presumptuous, but I think it's really alarming and even offensive for Governor Baker to say, yeah, this is pretty much over, because people are still getting sick and people are still dying. Look, it may be over on Beacon Hill and in Swampscott, but, you know, that's not reflective of lots of parts of this country, of the state.
Sure. Swampscott, where the governor lives, of course. Jane Swift, how about you? Are you, do you have any exciting plans this weekend, or are you similarly cautious as Renee is?
So, as I've mentioned on the show before and acknowledged publicly, my husband is in a very high-risk category. All of our family were vaccinated. He was vaccinated, but as a transplant recipient, we've been advised that he may not be protected with his vaccination. So I'm in a very different situation. As Renee said, there are pockets and individuals. Having said that, you know, I have been running my office fully remote. I have really valued colleagues who I haven't met yet in person. And so, yes, I'm looking forward to that. I will tell you, and I think this is more accepted maybe in the Northeast, but every small event or gathering that I've been invited to, and I think people are tiptoeing, have all articulated that people are welcome and excited, assuming that you've been vaccinated. And so I find it really interesting that despite sort of a lot of rhetoric about vaccine passports and not having requirements, a lot of the just beginnings of gatherings beyond immediate family that I'm seeing, in fact, vaccination is a prerequisite. And personally, I'm really grateful for that because that's a requirement for me to attend anything.
Sure. And I think a lot of folks feel the same way, but it's sort of case by case. As I said at the top, things are maybe a little bit more complicated than just a total repeal of the mask mandate. And I know that some of our listeners have thoughts on that point. Laura is calling from Newton. Go ahead, Laura.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My whole point on this is I'm vaccinated. My family is fully vaccinated. My 12-year-old is half vaccinated. So we're almost there. But I think one of the things we all have to remember is that we're all coming through a time of trauma. And as the panelists said, everyone's leading with their own sense of perspective and what they've dealt with, what kind of sense of loss, what kind of sense of trauma, what community they live in. And it's not as easy as just throwing a switch. And if I'm going to go into my local supermarket and they no longer require masks and I'm going to wear a mask, because of whatever's happening in my life and my feelings around it, we need to understand that people around us are all going to be in a different state of affairs, and we need to lead with grace, and we need to lead with respect, and we need to lead with this idea of compassion. And the other piece of
That's well said, Laura. I'm going to take it back from you because I do want to let some other people jump into the conversation. We've talked about pockets of the state where people have been especially hard hit. And I know, Brian, who's calling from Framingham, you have some folks in mind as well. What are you thinking about?
Well, yeah. Hi. Just what Laura was talking about is that there are a lot of us who are immunocompromised. And although I've received two doses of the Moderna vaccine, I have no antibodies against the virus. Keep us in mind, because the governor doesn't seem to be able to. I guess that's the end of my comment.
Brian, thanks for the call. And, you know, there is sort of this tricky spot where we're kind of relying on the honor system to some degree here, right? Because, you know, what the state is saying is that you're supposed to keep on masking indoors if you have not been vaccinated, but there's no easy enforcement on this. And, you know, John Hurst at the Retailers Association of Massachusetts made a point when he was talking about this week. He said it could actually put store owners and employees at various businesses in kind of a difficult position.
The last thing a small business wants to do, or a large business, is have to act like a policeman for their customers. That's why you're probably going to see some sort of posting in most establishments just to make it clear to their customers what the policy is.
So, Renee, I mean, just sort of taking all that into consideration, the position that businesses are in, the immunocompromised folks that we heard Brian talking about. I mean, if we're asking people to just mask up on their honor if they haven't been vaccinated, do you expect people will actually do it, or are we headed for a free-for-all?
Well, you know, I thought about this when the CDC said something to the effect of, we're going to trust people to do the right thing. And I thought, have you ever met people? I'm just not confident that everyone will do the right thing. If the thing is like, well, look, you know, if you are vaccinated, you don't need a mask. How do we know who is and isn't vaccinated? You can't tell, right? So the idea of just sort of throwing everything open and not taking into consideration people who are immunocompromised or who have other issues or who have not been vaccinated for whatever reason, it just seems a little foolhardy to me. I mean, I do like what Laura said about leading with grace, respect, and compassion. We've not done a lot of that in the last year, so I'm hard-pressed to think how we get there now, but we need to do something because I think simply the idea that we can all, you know, jam ourselves into a stadium or all eat indoors and do all these things and not taking into consideration that the pandemic is not over is a mistake. So I think we have to be smart about this and not assume that, you know, COVID-19 is completely in our rearview mirror.
Sure. I mean, just to put some numbers to it, we do have just one town still in the red zone in the state right now. That's Tisbury on Martha's Vineyard. There used to be more than a couple of hundred. So there's clear progress there. The overall infection rate is below 0.8%. So some really encouraging figures there. But over is premature in some folks' view, including, I understand, Jamie, who's calling from Brookline. Jamie, how are you thinking about the reopening this weekend and going forward?
I'm really nervous about it. I think it's a big risk, especially with young kids who there is no vaccine for the younger kids. We've got a lot of camps and summer activities. We have school reopening in the fall, and these kids won't be vaccinated. So I think it's a big risk for some of our most vulnerable members.
Jamie, thanks for the ring. So how about schools? I mean, we have the State Department of Education, Jane Swift, saying that we're looking at a basically back to normal fall, realizing that's several months away. But surely there are students and parents who feel that they're not ready for that step. What do you make of our education plan in the coming months?
Well, first of all, you have to give guidance now. School is nearly over and there's a ton of planning that has to be done. And I also just want to note my nonprofit Learn Launch works with the Department of Education to help school and district leaders to prepare to provide excellence in education. So I just wanted to disclose that up front. But, you know, if we don't give guidance now, then you're, you know, frustrating the leaders who have to be prepared to welcome students back in the fall. I think there's an important distinction between what the rules need to be for everyone. Shutting down an entire economy and having these restrictions are a drastic measure that protect our infrastructure and our public health infrastructure. Unfortunately, listen, like Brian, my husband is at very, very serious risk. Our family is going to make very different decisions than other families. By the way, we have been since 2018 when my husband was at risk from a whole host of viruses. My daughters and I will probably still wear masks in situations where other people won't. And so, you know, grace and respect and compassion, I think, are extremely important in those cases. But we also can't, unless there are threats to our healthcare institutions being overwhelmed, we have to also balance that against a lot of the harm that has been done and the social emotional impact on children and students by some of these restrictions. So I think it's just, it's a very complicated set of implications that have to be balanced.
Yeah, very complicated. And I think it's worth noting, Renee Graham, that, you know, this new decision to basically open things back up full force on May 29th, this weekend, is ahead of schedule. I mean, the governor had originally set the target as August 1st, and then he moved it up. And of course, he's surely hoping that residents will view that as a sign that his administration has managed things well. But he is facing some really tough questions about the state-run Holyoke Soldiers Home, where a coronavirus outbreak killed 76 veterans last year. And a report by the state legislature this week said Baker and his administration knew the facility was poorly run before the pandemic. So here's how the governor responded at a news conference today.
And I do hope, based on a quick read of the legislative report that came out a couple days ago, that we will be able to work with the legislature to implement many of the reforms that are in that report, which are very similar to the reforms that were recommended in the Perlstein report, so that we can make sure we have the right operating structure in place for Holyoke and the other soldiers' homes going forward.
So that Perlstein report that Baker referenced was an earlier review by the Boston attorney Mark Perlstein. And more recently, there was also a highly critical investigation by the Globe Spotlight team. So, Jane Swift, based on everything that you have read and know about the situation, how much responsibility does the governor bear for deadly mismanagement at the Holyoke Soldiers' Home?
So, ultimately, the governor is responsible for everything. He's responsible for the decision, as we just talked about, to open or not reopen. You're responsible for everything when you're the governor. And so I think it was an important step.
Sorry to cut you off, Jane, but what you just said, why is it so hard for a sitting governor to say that? Because that's not exactly what we've heard from Governor Baker. The buck stops with me.
Well, probably because the press can sort of splice your sound bites in such a way that they'll haunt you for the rest of your life.
Oh, so it's our fault. I'm just pulling your leg. But there are real political stakes here. I mean, Renee, what do you think about that? I mean, maybe it is that simple. We don't know for sure whether the governor will seek a third term next year, although he's widely expected to run again. I mean, is that basically the reason here?
I think it probably has a lot to do with it. It's interesting because I think what I'll remember about Charlie Baker's performance more than anything else was that headline in the Boston Globe last March that said, as other states declare emergencies over coronavirus, Baker was on vacation. That's what I'm going to think about. And that's what I think about when people talk about what happened at the veterans home. They're talking about one of the worst outbreaks in the country, 76 people dead. And again, as we saw with BPD, there's a lot of, well, I didn't know about that, and well, this didn't happen. And it seems to be that's not the case. What's being said publicly is not matching with what's being reported. And he's going to have to address this in a real way. At some point, whether he runs for governor for a third term or not, the buck is going to have to stop at his office. He can't keep playing kick the can. And that's what people are going to remember. If he decides to run, whether he wins or not, I think will be a referendum on what he's done in this past year during the pandemic.
Well, on that point, though, Renee, I mean, it is a convenient political position to take to say, hey, we should look forward and not backward, right? I mean, I think that's what we heard in his response there. But, I mean, does he have a point? I mean, should the focus be on reforms to prevent future tragedies as opposed to pointing the finger now?
You know, I never like this idea that somehow if you're trying to understand why what happened, that you're impeding progress. You can do both. You know, time is going to move on and you're going to move forward, but you need to understand what happened and why it happened so that if we're in this circumstance again, it doesn't happen again. I mean, this idea that, well, we don't want to talk about that thing. You're talking about stuff that happened months ago. We're not talking 20 years ago. So, sure. And people still don't
understand. A lot of the same debate happening right now on the national stage, right, about the January 6th insurrection,
everything. That's this idea that somehow if you're having these conversations about something that just happened, that you're not looking forward. You can do both because you have to do both.
I would just say that. Well,
Renee Graham, Jane Swift, go ahead, Jane, real quick, because I do want to give you a moment to get to your hubbubs.
Yeah. So we just did a workshop with the leading expert on crisis management who made a great point, which is it's also not fair to assume that someone should have known everything that we all know when we look back on something. Crises raise issues that nobody could have anticipated. That's why we call them a crisis. And so to sort of look back at something and say, oh my God, that's so obvious to us now. Why didn't you understand that or know that? Is I think that's the accountability that is sometimes unfair and why political leaders shy away from some of these sort of accountability mechanisms, because people want to judge your performance based on what we know now. That was maybe it's easy to see that that's how it played out now, but it wasn't so easy to see then.
All right. It's been a heavy week of news, to say the least. So I do want to leave just a moment at the end for our hubbubs, those brief local stories or events that caught our attention. Jane, I know you have one that you've been eager to share. So please go ahead in the moment that we have left.
There is no chlorine. We cannot open our pools. There's a chlorine shortage. And I just paid a gazillion dollars to have chlorine tabs shipped to me from California. It's come to this.
And Renee Graham, how about you? A first world problem, to say the least, but certainly
yes,
all the pool owners around here are noticing the same. Renee, what's your hubbub this week?
Alas, I don't have a pool. Last year, a lot of people turned to poetry for solace and for a deeper understanding of how to navigate this sort of unexpected place we found ourselves in. And just in time, next week comes the Roxbury Poetry Festival. First ever, the keynote speaker will be Jericho Brown, who won the 2020 Pulitzer for Poetry. Poetry's been a wonderful place for people to go. And I think this would be just sort of life affirming and spirit lifting, the Roxbury Poetry Festival.
Sounds like exactly what we need as we kind of step back out into the world, a little poetry to get us in the right mindset. Renee Graham, Boston Globe columnist and WBUR contributor, thank you as always for being with us.
Thank you, Cal.
Thanks also to former Massachusetts Governor Jane Swift, who is now the president and executive director of Learn Launch. Governor Swift, thank you and have a good weekend.
Thank you.